It's half past eight.
It's half past eight, New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, Lucky Strike invites you to try your hand at breaking down its panel of experts. You furnish the questions, and our experts try to answer them. For every question used, Lucky Strike will reward you with $10 in war stamps. If the question is muffed, you get a total of a $50 war bond plus the 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid. And all questions become the property of Information Please. And now light up a lucky strike as I present our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information Please, as you know, goes right on as always, completely unhampered by any preparation or forethought or pomp or circumstance. Tonight our panel consists of our two old-timers, Franklin P. Adams and John Kieran, and as our special guests, the noted actress and writer Cornelia Otis Skinner, and the critic and author, whose new book, Thoroughfare, will soon be published, Mr. Christopher Morley. We're going to begin with a question from Mrs. David B. Summer of Montgomery, Minnesota. Can you quote the line of poetry or song that tells what happened or happens in the following instances? Let's get two out of three on that. What happens, quote, when faith is lost, when honor dies, close quote. Well, if you know the end of that line, you will have the answer to the question, what happens? What happens when faith is lost, when honor dies? Mr. Morley, is that a familiar one to you? Is the quotation familiar at all?
Well, something terrible happens to the man, but I forget who he was.
You've got it. That's 98% right. What happens to the man? Miss Skinner, does the line come back to you? It's a line from Whittier's poem, Ichabod. When faith is lost, when honor dies, the man is dead. You see, you were right, Mr. Morley. But I have to count that as wrong, nevertheless.
I wasn't brief enough.
And had reference to a vote of Daniel Webster, didn't it?
Well, now, this is a fine time to give us all the exact facts, Mr. Kieran. Of course, that's exactly right.
He voted the wrong way, according to Whittier, on one of the slavery or anti-slavery motions in Congress.
So, yes, I think it was the Compromise Bill of 1850. And Whittier was against him on that, and this is the quotation that's become famous. You did know it then, Mr. Kieran.
I knew it, but I was looking for a rhyme, and there wasn't any rhyme.
Oh, that's what gets you.
True.
See if you can do better on this one. What happened, quote, when you wore a tulip? Close quote. Mr. Skinner.
I wore a big red rose.
Yes, yes, that's right. And how does it go on? Do you remember the...
Your lips were sweeter than julep when you wore a tulip and I wore a big red rose.
That's right, yes, very good. How about this one? When lovely woman stoops to folly. We have four hands on this. Mr. Morley.
And finds too late that men betray what art can soothe her melancholy, what something can charm her something away.
Tears away. Tears can wash her guilt away.
You haven't told us yet, Mr. Morley, though that quotation's very good, just what happens when lovely woman stoops to folly.
Same thing that happened to Ichabod. She dies.
Yes. Can you give us the last four lines, Miss Skinner? Do you remember
and
them?
The only act her something to cover and... Bring repentance to her, lover. And something is to die.
To hide her guilt from every eye.
You sound a little like Adams on those somethings. He's very good at that, too. let's get it all clear. Mr. Kieran, I bet you can give it to us.
The only art her guilt to cover, to hide her guilt from every eye, to...
Wring repentance.
To wring repentance from her lover.
Uh-huh. That's
approximately right.
Why don't you read Goldsmith and find it out?
Well, to give repentance to her lover and wring his bosom is to die. Many critics of poetry have called those the most perfect eight lines in English verse. But, of course, there are lots of other lines that are better. They didn't happen to be eight lines.
Flatterer.
Mr. Adams, where do you find those eight lines?
In Goldsmith.
Correct. In what book?
Maybe in She Stoops to Conquer.
No, I think not.
No.
Miss Skinner?
The Vicar of Wakefield.
Yes, in the Vicar of Wakefield.
I called that some years ago the Wicker of Wakefield on this.
Yes, a well-known wicker. That's quite right.
Try it again.
That gives us two out of three. Now, how about this one from Kathleen G. Holden of New York City? We're thinking a good deal these days about nurses. Here's a question about nurses of fiction. This first nurse was very fond of liquor. It's, of course, a fictional nurse. Who was that? Mr. Morley.
Sounds like Sary Gamp.
It is Sary Gamp. Who is Sary Gamp, Mr. Morley?
Well, she was a sort of a monthly nurse in Dickens.
Yes, what book?
Probably David Copperfield.
No. Improbably, David Copperfield. Martin Chuzzlewit.
Martin Chuzzlewit.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. That's right.
Her friend was Mrs. Arris.
Yes, and didn't exist, isn't that?
Didn't exist.
The mythical Mrs. Arris. What nurse of fiction mixed up two babies? Miss Skinner.
Little Buttercup in,
Pinafore. In Franklin Adams's Pinafore. Yes, that's right. Now, the well-born babe was Ralph, and your captain was the other. That is right. Now, what nurse, again, this nurse is in a novel.
Rafe.
A big pardon?
Rafe, yes.
Oh, yes, you must say Rafe, I forget. The well-born babe was Rafe, your captain was the other. Okay. What nurse of fiction eloped with her ex-patient? Eloped with her ex-patient. Miss Skinner?
No, I guess I'm wrong. I was thinking of Jane Eyre, but she wasn't a nurse and she didn't elope.
She was a governess and she didn't elope. It's a good plot, but that isn't the plot of Jane Eyre. Mr. Adams, Mr. Kieran?
No.
In Hemingway's novel, A Farewell to Arms, Catherine Barclay, the nurse, elopes with Lieutenant Frederick Henry. We got two right and one wrong on that. How about this one? This comes from Annie Laurie von Tungeln of Tulsa, Oklahoma. What would a housewife be trying to ascertain, to test, if she did the following things? Suppose she stuck or put her elbow into it. Mr. Kieran.
The temperature of water.
Yes,
but what purpose? Bathe the baby.
Oh, yes. You've been through this, Mr. Kieran. I see that. That's right. Is that right, Miss Skinner?
Yes.
That's quite right. Now, suppose she pulled her hand through it. What would she be trying to ascertain if she pulled her hand through it, Mr. Morley? Miss Skinner?
Well, that might refer to something in the way of cooking. I think maybe dough. I don't know how to cook, but...
Apparently not.
Or molasses candy.
Well, that's a messy idea. Pull your hand through molasses. Goodness gracious. It's possible.
To see if it was... Done.
No. Miss Skinner, have you ever bought stockings?
Yes.
Well, when you buy a pair of stockings, don't you pull your hand through the stocking to see whether there's a hole in it?
Oh, yes, but that sounds like you're pulling it through the whole stocking.
Well, more or less. And not through the whole stocking, because that would be tough on the end of the stocking, but you put your hand through it and sort of slide it around, see whether there are any holes in it. You get the quality of the weave that way, do you not?
Yes.
Well, thank heaven I sold you on it.
Push your hand.
Yes,
push
you push your hand through it.
You don't pull
it. I hope you haven't got any rings on.
Oh, that's pretty technical, Chris. All right, you push your hand through it. I think we got that wrong anyway. Now, what would you be trying to test if you dropped it into cold water, Mr. Morley?
Fudge.
Fudge is right, yes. Now, what happens when you drop fudge into cold water?
Well, if the fudge is approximately cooked, it coagulates.
Yes.
Nucleolates.
Yes, very good. Form small, soft...
Pellets,
yes, in cold water. Well, I guess we got two out of three on that. How about this from Jesse Margaret Town of Omaha? Here is a Shakespearean question. What characters from Shakespeare spoke these words? In each case, the words were uttered toward the end of their careers. That would be in round Act 5, Mr. Kieran, I suppose. Here's the first. I have lived long enough. My way of life has fallen into the sear, the yellow leaf. Miss Skinner?
That's Richard II.
I think not.
Then it's
Though it
King
might,
Lear.
It's appropriate, but it is not Richard II. Mr. Kieran, how about another?
Well, it isn't Richard II and it isn't Lear.
Keep going.
Oh, I know. It's Macbeth.
Yes, Macbeth. Yeah. I wish you'd said that first, Miss Skinner.
I wish I had.
Have to count you wrong, but Macbeth is correct. Now, how about this one? Dost thou not, beg pardon,
Mr.
Kieran?
That's where he said, I begin to be aweary of the world.
That is the one, yes, a very famous speech. Dost thou not see my baby at my breast that sucks the nurse asleep? Mr. Morley.
That's Cleopatra.
Yes, Cleopatra.
Alluding to the snake.
Snake, yes, quite right. How about this one? And my poor fool is hanged. No life. Mr. Kieran.
That is Lear.
That is Lear, yes. Do you know how that goes on?
He was referring to his daughter.
That's right. And remember how the quotation continues?
Well, no, I don't.
Why should a dog, a horse, a rat have life and thou no breath at all? From King Lear. We did get 2 out of 3 on that, too. Here's one from May E. Colton of Los Angeles. Identify these songs by their first 2 lines. All I will tell you is that the songs themselves are very familiar. Everyone listening tonight will know them, but these lines may not be familiar. Here's the first set of lines. Down in front of Casey's old brown wooden stoop, on a summer's evening, we formed a merry group. Mr. Adams.
Sidewalks of New
That's
York.
That's quite right. The Sidewalks of New York. Very good. Now, here's another. I'm dreaming now of Hallie, sweet Hallie, sweet Hallie, Miss Skinner.
Listen to the mockingbird.
Very good.
And listen the mockingbird is singing where she lies.
That places it all right, Mr. Adams. And here. Oh, the night that I struck New York, I went out for a quiet walk. Mr. Adams.
The Bowery.
The Bowery is right, yes. One of the most famous of all songs. Now, who wrote The Bowery?
Charles H. Hoyt.
Charles H. Hoyt. And I bet not very many people would know that, Mr. Adams. Or do you contradict me?
I'm like that.
And now Mr. Cross has something to say about the family tree of a cigarette.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that family tree leads straight to the tobacco auctions down south. For any cigarette inherits its characteristics of taste and mildness from the tobacco bought for it at those 1,001 auctions. So it means a lot to you that at market after market, year after year, the makers of Lucky Strike cigarettes consistently pay the price to get the milder, better quality leaf. For example, in Pamplico, South Carolina, at auctions of the 1939 crop, the American Tobacco Company paid 34% more for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. That's right, 34% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. And that crop, properly aged, mellowed, and blended with other fine crops, is in the Luckies you buy today. Yes, Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. And in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. Mr. Fadiman, aren't these facts worth every smoker's consideration?
Yes, Mr. Cross, the facts tell the story, and with admirable brevity in just 58 seconds. Now we have a question from Isaiah Heller of Long Island City, New York. Each of these words is derived from the name of an animal. Give me the animal. And they're all very simple words. The first word is muscle. Muscle? The word muscle is derived from the name of an animal. Mr. Morley.
It means a little mouse.
Quite right, little mouse. So, Mr. Adams, can you give us the Latin? Mr. Morley, can
Mosca,
you?
Mosca, a mouse.
Mosca
is a fly. Mosca is a fly, but it's a little mouse. That's how you get the L in muscle. Now, what would the little, Mr.
Diminutive.
Kieran, diminutive would be what?
Musculum.
Yeah, musculus, yes. The Latin, a little mouse. I suppose it's because muscles
looks
do
like
look...
It
slips
like
up and down
they
your
creep
arm
up and down, yes, that's right.
Do they
Stay where you are, Mr. Skinner. There's nothing to be alarmed about. Here is another word, tragedy. Tragedy is derived also from the name of an animal. What animal? It's an interesting derivation. Mr. Morley, you want to guess at it? Miss Skinner, you have acted in tragedy?
Not much.
Any idea how we got the word?
No, no.
It's from a Greek word, tragos, meaning goat. And I guess the goat song, goat leaping ceremony is thought by some scholars to have been the origin of the exhibitions and ceremonials which later developed into real tragic plays. Tragos, goat. How about the word cynic? The word cynic. I have several hands. Mr. Kieran.
Dog.
Yes, what's the derivation?
Well, that's a Latin word for dog.
Greek word.
The Greek word is right. I guess it's kion. We get the word cynic from it. And why should cynic come from
because,
the word dog, Mr. Kieran?
Well, because you sometimes refer to a fellow as a dirty dog or a nasty dog or something like that. I mean, the same parallel derivation.
Yes, it's an ugly, unpleasant sort of person who always snapping at you is a cynic, and so from dog. How about this? This is a question from Mrs. H.L. Bruswitz of Buffalo. Very simple question. Give me, let's say, 3 lines of poetry, each of which mentions coats, C-O-A-T-S, a coat or some coats. Any line of poetry with the word coats in it. Mr. Kieran?
Oh, Grimes is dead. That good old man, he always wore a coat of tan.
Oh, no.
Well, no?
He always wore a something coat all buttoned up before.
Well, yes,
buttoned down.
Buttoned down. Old Grimes is dead, that good old man. We never shall see more. He used to wear a long black coat, all buttoned down.
I know he wore a coat in a poem.
But Mr. Kieran's got the right poem and approximately the right quotation. Now, how about another quotation with the word coat in it? That gives us only one. Shall I help you out? I'll give you the first line, Mr. Adams, and you give me the second. I love little pussy.
Her coat is so warm.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. But little credit to you, little credit to you. How about another one? One from The Walrus and the Carpenter with coat in it. That's about the oysters. You remember the eager little oysters? The four young oysters who hurried up all eager for a treat. Their coats were brushed, their faces washed, their shoes were clean and
this
neat.
Was very odd because they hadn't any feet.
That's the one. I guess we have to muff this one. That sends a $50 war bond to Mrs. Breswitz and a set of the Britannica. Another one is from a favorite poem of yours, Mr. Kieran, is a coat of the claret velvet and...
Oh, yes, the highway.
That's the only poem he knows.
How about one from... A couple of lines from Browning's The Lost Leader that mention the word coat. Mr. Kieran.
Yes. Miss Skinner. Just for a handful of silver he left. Just for
ribbon to
ribbon
put in his coat.
Yes, you all know it once you've given a little cue. All right, how about this from Deborah Ishlan of Brooklyn, New York. What geographical spot is suggested by each of the musical compositions that you're going to hear? They're going to be three, and I think we ought to get two out of three. Let's have the first, Mr. Kahn. Miss Skinner?
Londonderry.
Londonderry, yes. What's being played?
The Londonderry Air.
Yes, the Londonderry Air. And where is Londonderry?
In Ireland.
Yes, in the northern part, Mr. Kieran.
Well, I was going to say in the north.
Yes, northern part of Ireland. Now, how about the next one? This perhaps a little more difficult. The music is familiar, Miss Skinner.
It's Tchaikovsky. And it's Romeo and Juliet.
Yes, and what spot would that be?
Well, Verona.
Verona, yes. Verona in Italy, where Romeo and Juliet had their affair. And the third and last? I get a blank look on that one from our experts this
evening. Help if I knew what it was.
It would help. No doubt the answer would come to you if you only knew the response, Mr. Adams. How about it? Is the tune...
It's perfect. I know, but I don't recall. I recognize the tune, but I can't...
Want to hear it again? Let's have it again, Mr. Kahn.
I don't think it'll do any good.
Well, gosh, it's a very popular song of some years ago, Miss Skinner.
Isn't it Gershwin?
No. I think it was pre-Gershwin. Lena was the queen of what, Mr. Kieran? Palestina, yes. So that it would be Palestine, yes. That gives us two out of three. Bad muff on that last one. How about this one from Mrs. Henry Miles of Brookings, South Dakota? I don't know which of you are mystery story addicts. Do you read mystery stories, Miss Skinner?
No, I'm afraid.
You want to rest on your laurels for a minute or two? How about this? Name a well-known mystery story in which even the criminal does not know who committed the crime. That doesn't seem to make any sense. But it's true. Even the criminal does not know who committed the crime. Any ideas? Miss Skinner.
Well, it's that could apply to the murders in the Rue Morgue. I don't suppose an ape
knew what he was doing.
Committed a crime.
Well, that's very clever. That's quite conceivably true. He wouldn't have any sense of guilt about it.
No, he'd have no sense of having.
That's a very possible answer. Never would have thought of it, Mr. Morley.
I was thinking of The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins, where the crime is committed by a woman under the influence of somnambulistic hypnotism.
Yes, it's exactly right, except I think it's the Moonstone rather than the Woman in White. I think it's the Miss Verinder, isn't it, who's a somnambulist, walks in her sleep and doesn't know what she's doing. That's exactly the answer, Mr. Morley.
Well,
Mr.
she
Kieran?
Is a woman walking in white. That's what...
that's what mixes you up. I'm pretty sure it's the Moonstone by Wilkie Collins. But I think either of those answers would be quite correct. Now, how about a mystery story in which the narrator is presumably the victim of murder? That, again, doesn't seem to make much sense. The narrator is presumably the victim of murder. Thinks he or she is going to be the victim of murder for some time in the course of the story. Well, it's in Before the Fact, the novel from which Suspicion with Cary Grant and Joan Fontaine was made. The heroine tells the story up to the point where she is given a glass of milk, which she believes is poisoned, and for a time she's presumably the victim of
seems that she's going to be the victim of the murder. That's one wrong. How about this? A mystery story in which the murderer is also the narrator. Mr. Morley.
That's the famous first novel by Agatha Christie. But I can't think of its title.
You've got it all right. The first two words of the title are The Murder.
Does the Murder of Roger Ackroyd.
Very good, Mr. Morley, yes.
And the author of the other one you spoke of was Francis Iles.
Francis Iles is right. The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, didn't that cause something of a revolution in mystery storytelling, Mr. Morley? It was an unusual trick.
It caused a great deal of scandal among professional writers of mystery stories.
They were very sore at Miss Christie for daring to make the murderer the narrator. They felt that she'd been unfair to the reader. Have odd codes of ethics, Mr. Story Writers do. But that gives us 2 out of 3. How about this one from Mrs. Annie Preston of New Brunswick, New Jersey? Who, according to song or poetry, hadn't been kissed in 40 years? This, by the way, Miss Skinner, is a tragedy. You seem to be...
Yes,
I didn't know what
definitely.
It was a few minutes ago. Hadn't
That's
been
a
kissed...
song.
Sure it is, Mr. Adams. And
I don't know what song it
well,
is.
Well, I bet you do.
No, I don't.
Well, I hate to contradict you, Mr. Adams, but I know you know. Matter of fact, you're an expert on
I think
Mr. Kieran.
Is it Caddyshaw?
No. Oh, no. Goodness gracious. And both of you were in the last war? Mr. Kieran, Mr. Adams?
Armenteers.
Yes, Armenteers. What were you doing in the last war, gentlemen?
Not singing.
The same is true of this one, Mr. Adams, as far as you're concerned. I don't think I ought to get credit on that because I threw that in your laps. It was a nice catch. How about this? Who never used a big D? Miss Skinner.
It was the captain of the pinafore.
Captain of the pinafore, yes. Remember how that is phrased?
Yes, never use a... bad language or abuse, I never use, whatever the emergency. Though, darn
bother it,
something.
I say.
I may occasionally say I never use a big D.
That's the
what, never?
No, never.
You're rather good. How about this? Who never says a foolish thing, nor ever does a wise one? Mr. Kieran.
Well, that was supposedly written by Rochester on King Charles.
Our sovereign liege.
Yes, there were two Charleses.
Second.
Which one was it? Charles II. Here lies our sovereign lord, the king, whose word
no man relies on, who never said a foolish thing and never did a wise one.
Yes, it's in the present. It's a very clever quatrain. It's in the present tense. He never says a foolish thing, nor ever does a wise one, and it's supposed to have been written on the door of the bedchamber of Charles II. It was not an epitaph after his death. Well, that gives us 2 out of 3. Now, how about this? From H. Campbell Scarlett of Columbus, Ohio. Identify the trios of sisters that I'll list. Here's the first trio. Voglinda, Velgunda, und Floss Hilda. Miss Skinner, who are these three sisters?
They're probably... related to Brunhilde. They're sisters. They're probably Valkyries.
Well, they're in Wagner, all right. They're not...
probably the three German fates.
No, there's only one German fate, and they're getting to know which one it is. The three Rhine maidens.
Oh, of course.
In the Nibelungen,
yes,
the Ring of the Nibelungs. Well, you were sort of hovering around it, Miss Skinner. Voglinda, Velgunda, Flosshilde. Now I shall give you, after having given you my German, I shall now give you my very best Chinese, which is worse. Who are these? Ailing.
Song sisters.
Say, that's good.
Perfect.
You realize, of course, Mr. Adams.
Only Chinese girl I really know.
You know that you're shortening this program. That is quite right. Famous sisters, as Mr. Adams says, of the Song family. Ailing, do you mind if I go on with this for just a second? Ailing, Meiling, and Qingling. The names have a rather beautiful meaning. They're loving mood, beautiful mood, and happy mood are what the hieroglyphics mean in our language. And respectively, who are these? Who are these Song sisters, Mr. Adams? You know, they're all very famous.
I don't have to tell them.
No, that's true. One is Madame H.H. Kung. Another is Madame Chiang Kai-shek, the wife of the Generalissimo, and one is the widow of Sun Yat-sen, all married a very great and famous Chinese. Now, here's another trio. Lola, Rosa Marie, and Priscilla. Miss...
Lane?
Yes, they're motion picture actresses, and they appear together in what picture? remember?
I don't know.
Perhaps several, but one called Four Daughters. I don't know how the extra one got in. Lola, Rosemary, and Priscilla Lane. Well, I guess we did pretty well on that. We got 2 out of 3. And now, before we go on to the next question, here's Mr. Cross, who's brought with him tonight a sort of miniature cigarette counter.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have here packages of all the different brands of cigarettes you see at an average cigarette counter. Now, I want to point out a distinction that means a lot to you as smokers. Out of all these different cigarettes, one, Lucky Strike, has gained the overwhelming preference of independent tobacco experts, auctioneers, buyers, and warehousemen. In fact, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-to-1. Surely this expert stamp of approval on Lucky's is your best guide to greater smoking enjoyment. For remember, tobacco experts see just who buys what tobacco. At markets all over the South, year after year, they see the makers of Lucky's consistently pay the price to get the finer, lighter, milder leaf. Yes, tobacco experts know that Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. And in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. So smoke the smoke tobacco experts smoke.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. That took just 57 seconds. We'll go on with a question from Mary Estelle of Minneapolis. Who's the fictional character, Miss Skinner and gentlemen, who began a new life in the following places? The first one began a new life in Australia. Who was that? Mr. Kieran.
That was Micawber.
Yes, in what?
Wilkins Micawber and David Copperfield.
David Copperfield. Now, how about a character who began a new life in Siberia? Which one was that? Also a very famous novel.
That's Tolstoy.
No, you've got the right nation, but the wrong writer. Miss Skinner?
Michael Strogoff.
No.
Dostoevsky.
What is the book?
Oh, gosh, I forget that.
Well, it's the character Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment, who commits the crime and is punished and goes to Siberia, begins a new life there. Now, how about Tahiti? Who begins a new life in Tahiti, Mr. Morley?
Somerset Maugham's novel about the painter...
Van Gogh.
Van Gogh.
No.
Supposed to be Gauguin.
Gauguin, yes. But
he called him
Charles...
Else.
He did, though.
Strickland.
Charles Strickland.
Pardon? Gauguin really did that.
Yes,
yes, that's quite
a fiction
true.
Character. Really.
I think we'll have time for one more question from Maya Splaver of New York City. What geographical bodies are distinguished by these pairs of adjectives? Greater and lesser. Mr. Adams.
The Antilles.
The Antilles, yes. How about another pair of adjectives? Blue and white. Blue and white what? Mr. Kieran.
Nile.
The Nile River. And inner and outer. Mr. Morley?
Mongolia.
Mongolia. Inner and outer Mongolia. We've got 3 out of 3 on that. Well, I guess that's all we'll have time for. Thank you, Miss Skinner and Mr. Morley, for joining us this evening. Now, in a few seconds, I'll announce next week's guests. Tonight, Lucky Strike has paid out one set of the Encyclopedia Britannica and one $50 war bond. And, ladies and gentlemen, speaking of bonds... Have you joined the finest, the most inclusive club in the world? The 10% Club, consisting of Americans who will agree to buy war bonds regularly to the extent of 10% or more of their present income. Ladies and gentlemen, there's the club to smash the Axis. Join up today and get your 10% button. Now, next week, Mr. John Kieran and Mr. Franklin P. Adams will be on hand, ready and willing, and they will be aided by two guests. First, our old friend Jan Struther, on whose novel is based the sensational moving picture success, Mrs. Miniver. And as our second guest, a very famous journalist, Mr. Frederick C. Uexner, a United Press correspondent who just returned from Germany, I think about 2 weeks ago, on the Drottning home. Remember to send your letters with questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, at 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now we listen to a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, famous tobacco auctioneer from Goldsboro, North Carolina.